Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a big win for workers as a family feud is settled.
But first, President Obama will meet with his national security advisors later today as he develops a game plan on how to deal with the Islamic State, or ISIS, in Iraq and Syria. ISIS militants have been moving easily between those two countries, effectively blurring the border. The president is weighing whether the U.S. should expand airstrikes into Syria. But some members of Congress are saying he must go through them before taking that action. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson joins us now from Washington, D.C. with more. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Sasha.
And Carrie, Congress, for the most part, seemed to be supportive of the targeted initial airstrikes in Iraq against ISIS. But now the administration is weighing whether to expand the operation in Iraq and also expand it into Syria. Tell us what the administration is saying.
Well, the administration has been fairly tight-lipped about the strategy. We do know, Sasha, about this meeting later today in Washington of the president's national security advisors, Vice President Biden, Secretary of State John Kerry, going to be phoning in via secure phone lines from their travels. The National Security Council would only say today that no decisions would be announced after the meeting this afternoon. We're hearing the White House, though, wants to have a handle on what it will do within the next few days.
And how about the members of Congress who are speaking up about this? Who are they and what's their perspective?
Well, as you mentioned, Sasha, people initially in Congress seem to support these ideas. But a number of lawmakers, mostly from the liberal left, have been pressing the White House now to get a formal authorization from Congress to use military force, not just in Iraq, but also potentially moving into Syria. They are arguing that such a serious step would and should involve lawmakers, not just the executive branch, not just the White House. And there are some influential voices in this debate. Starting with Tim Kaine, who's a senator from Virginia and a Democrat who's been quite close to the White House. He's been really outspoken about the need for Congress to act here. And so have quite a few House members. This week, they wrote a letter to Speaker of the House John Boehner. They include Barbara Lee, a Democrat of California, James McGovern, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and also a Republican, Walter Jones, from North Carolina. But, Sasha, it's important to note these are not lawmakers who have the power to set an agenda. They're not as influential voices as a committee chairman in the Armed Services or Intelligence Committees might be. So this debate is around the fringes, not within the center of Congress.
Carrie, in terms of the law, is it legally necessary for Congress to sign off on expanded military action?
Well, the White House has power to act to defend Americans and U.S. interests, both under the Constitution, Article 2 of the Constitution, and to act in self-defense under international law. There is something called the War Powers Resolution. That gives the White House about 90 days to either declare war or involve Congress. And that clock started to tick when President Obama sent troops to Iraq in June. But I'm told that there are ways to be creative about the math. For instance, the White House could argue each time it sent a new batch of people to Iraq, the clock started all over again. And of course, Sasha, there still is an authorization to use military force in place for Iraq and another for al-Qaeda, which Congress signed off on shortly after 9/11. The issue is we're so far away from 9/11 and the threat looks so different that many lawmakers and legal experts think the White House would be on firmer ground if they do involve Congress now.
Okay, so there are legal options, however, not to. But in terms of the implications for the president, if he moved ahead without congressional approval, what would that mean for him?
Well, this would be a really bold step and in some ways a repudiation of what candidate Barack Obama came into office promising. He was very critical of the Bush administration for usurping and taking up too much executive power and not consulting with Congress in Iraq and elsewhere overseas. And so for him to, in essence, take this path without asking Congress to formally authorize the use of force would expose him potentially to charges of hypocrisy here. I'm told also, Sasha, that Obama is worried about leaving a blank check for his successor. Some of the arguments he's making here could also apply to the next president down the road. And he is very careful in keeping that in mind moving forward. And of course, there's going to be a political price to pay either way.
If the president does involve Congress, this is certainly not a Congress known for getting things done quickly. So given that, could a decision be made before the November midterm elections?
It's hard to imagine how. Lawmakers are in session for fewer than 14 days in September, and they've been so dysfunctional and so unable to agree on even basic functions of government, it's difficult to see them agreeing on an issue this complicated and politically sensitive in the run-up to the November midterm elections. In fact, some of the criticism unnamed members of Congress and congressional aides has come in the past few days from some of these against some of these lawmakers who are asking for congressional action here. Their colleagues say, we don't want to take those kinds of votes before the midterm elections.
That's NPR's justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now to a big business headline. After 6 weeks of a family feud that became national news and maybe some sort of watershed moment for workers, owners of the New England-based Market Basket grocery store chain have reached a deal. At the heart of the fight, two cousins, both named Arthur, fighting over control of the company their fathers founded. Thousands of employees sided with their longtime boss, Arthur T. Demoulas, who'd been ousted by the board of directors, which largely backed Arthur S. Demoulas. In the deal, Arthur T.'s side of the family bought out the Arthur S. side. And today, Arthur T. addressed a huge crowd of workers at the company's Massachusetts headquarters.
The associates of Market Basket, the customers of Market Basket, and the vendors of this Market Basket organization, you and only you have taught the educators, the analysts, and the CEOs that the workplace here at Market Basket is so much more than just a job.
Yeah. Kurt Nikisch is business and technology reporter for the Here and Now contributor station WBUR, where we sit. And Kurt, seven workers lost their jobs rather than switch sides, but thousands of part-timers lost their shifts, and now they're all told they can have their jobs back. What was it like, first of all, this morning?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, some people were smoking cigars. They were patting themselves on the back, and they had been going through this ordeal for 6 weeks, and you really got the sense that they're even closer together now.
And tell people, I mean, this is a national story, but tell people more who hadn't been following it as closely. These workers, a lot of them put their jobs on the line.
Yeah, they walked off the jobs and they basically made history. They basically said, you know, we had a CEO who we believed in, who took care of us, and when he was in trouble, we took care of him. So they walked off the jobs, not just rank and file workers, but also managers. So this is different from what you traditionally think of as a strike. And they basically shut the company down, kept food from getting to the stores, and they forced the company, which had been losing millions of dollars per day, to basically give in and hand the company over.
Well, let's be clear about that, because this case has so many analysts baffled because many haven't seen this much unity from employees without a union. So are you saying that really it was the workers and then the customers who sided with the workers that forced this deal?
Yeah, the workers certainly made it easier for customers to back them because there wasn't any food in the stores for them to buy. So customers boycotted, but it was also a pretty practical boycott, right?
Yeah.
But I think the big thing here is that they used today's internet technology, social media, to rally around a common demand to organize very quickly, totally caught this company by surprise, even though they probably shouldn't have. And they made something happen that any union would be amazed to and very pleased to have accomplished.
And this is a complicated, decades-long fight over this business, and it gets very complicated on many levels. But a lot of people have been running the numbers, and this was a company under Arthur T.'s direction that did have lower-priced food than other areas. So there were other symbols here as well for people.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a discount retailer. So a lot of low-income immigrant student customers, for instance. And the workers are blue-collar, just through and through hard workers. And this is also a very close regional chain. It's sort of North Boston Shore, Northern New England, and it's just that geography is just also kind of a common identity.
How many stores?
71.
So no small thing. What's the agreement that was made?
So Arthur T. Demoulas, the ousted CEO, gets to come back. He's back in charge. He is buying out his cousin's side, Arthur Estimulis, for $1.5 billion.
Big company, $1 billion.
Yeah. They have $4+ billion in sales. So it's they push out a lot of product, and he's taking it over then. And this basically, this deal does end this family feud, because it sort of eliminates one side.
Which is always, I mean, it was in that way very traditional. It always went back to one side of the family thought that they weren't getting as much from the company as they should. And there were some accusations that Arthur T. was giving too much of the revenue of the company to the workers. And so it had that to it. But we said everyone's been promised their jobs so many days out of business. Some would say, we're saying this company was on the brink of absolute failure. Is this possible they'll have their jobs back?
Yeah, not right away for the part-time workers. You talked about the 12,000-plus part-time workers who lost their shift. Some of them are working again today, but it's going to take a while for stores to fill up with product again and for all of them to be back at work. But all the full-time workers, I went into a warehouse today, and the forklifts are rolling again. The trucks are going out, loaded up full, and they have this look in their eyes like, we are going to get this company back on its feet and show people that the sacrifice was worth it. I talked to Brian Oliveira, and he's a warehouse worker in that same warehouse. Here's what he had to say.
I appreciate all the customers that stood behind us, you know what I mean? That was a big part of us staying out here. The customers helped us a lot.
Right.
So we're just hoping the customers bear with us for a little bit, you know what I mean? Give us the rest of this week. We'll have these freaking stores loaded up and ready to go by the end of this week. No problem.
Well, but there are questions as to whether they can do that now after not just 6 weeks of protests, but all the suppliers that were not working with them over this time.
Yeah, in that same warehouse, there were loading bays of things going out, but the receivables section, those were empty because the suppliers had stopped sending stuff over. And that's going to take a few weeks to sort out. The longer question is, how much money have they lost, and when can they really get this up and rolling again? And at what expense?
Right. Yeah. And how will this be taught in business schools? Do workers have the power, or do owners have a power to create a great workspace so your workers back you when something like this happens? It'll be fascinating to see. Kurt Nikisch, business and technology reporter for the Here and Now contributing station, WBUR. Thanks for following this story for us for several weeks now. Thank you.
But of course.
You're listening to Here and Now. And if you're looking for one last summer read, Wally Lamb's We Are Water has just been released in paperback. Like his best-selling I Know This Much Is True, We Are Water explores how the past impacts the present. The book opens with the story of Josephus Jones, a self-taught African-American artist from the 1950s, on the cusp of acclaim when he's found dead in a well in Connecticut. Then suddenly, we're at a modern-day same-sex wedding, the marriage of artist Annie and art dealer Vivica. Vivica has picked out three Vera Wang dresses for Annie to choose from, selecting one for herself that even has a name, Gaia, for Earth Goddess. Well, that provokes a rage in Annie that always seems just below the surface, and as we're about to hear, fuels her provocative and disturbing artwork.
Before I can stop myself, mug in hand, I throw my wine at her pale green wedding gown. It lands halfway down the skirt. The red wine against the green silk makes it look like Gaia, the primordial Earth Mother, is having her period. I know I should feel guilty, contrite. I should be rushing to the fridge and grabbing a bottle of club soda before the stain sets, or rushing Vivica's dress down the street to that dry cleaning place. But I'm not contrite. I'm a little giddy, in fact. I pour another mug of wine and throw it at the other three dresses. In some places, the wine seeps in, and it dribbles down to the hems and others. I do it again. Pour, splash. I feel like Jackson Pollock must have felt, except I'm not dribbling paint. I'm staining beauty with blood.
Wally Lamb reading the words of his character Annie. Behind her anger, she was abused as a child, and a devastating flood swept away her mother. Oh, and did we mention that Annie and her ex-husband owned the house and well where that outsider artist Jones died in the 1950s. Wally Lamb weaves all of these stories together in We Are Water, and we spoke to him when the book was first published and asked him where these stories came from.
I grew up in Norwich, Connecticut, and I based the story or started springboarding from two incidents. One was a devastating flood that happened in March of 1963. I was 12 years old, and the floodwaters came about six or seven houses down from where we were. And I still have vivid memories of the roaring water rushing past and also the screams of people buried alive in a mill that collapsed. Four or five people died. Yeah, four from the mill, and then a young mother who had three little boys, age four, age two, and infant. She and her husband were attempting to rescue the kids. He climbed up into a tree. She was handing the kids up to him, and then the flood water took her away, and she died.
Mm.
So that was one. The other is an African-American artist who lived in Norwich, same as I did, back in the 40s and 50s. And he was a laborer. He was unschooled, but his stuff was vivid, and it suggested story. Now, the real artist's name was Ellis Ruley. He couldn't sell paintings in his own lifetime, but since about the 70s and 80s, he became, you know, posthumous.
The collectibles.
Very famous, yeah.
So there are these two truthful threads, and we should explain that Annie, your character, her mother and a sibling died in a terrible flood. That's her backstory.
Right.
Well, and so exercising this yourself, but Annie is also trying to exorcise that flood, and not always in an appealing way. She's not always appealing, this character. She is abusive to her kids sometimes.
Yeah, she targets her male child especially.
Yeah. What were you saying there?
I think I was making a comment about how toxic long-held secrets can be. Annie, she was abused sexually as a little girl, and that sort of plays out in her life. Somebody a couple of days ago said, who had been sexually abused, a woman said to me, you know, it's a very hard thing to get over when the crime scene is your own body. Mm. And boy, did that sort of bring it home for me.
Well, in addition to having the voice in her head of her abuser and the memory of this flood that took her mother and sibling, she's got this cyclone that comes. It's the storm that propels when you've got a good idea, when you there's something you have to write about, something you have to do. It is almost like a windstorm in your head.
Mm-hmm.
She's got that. Do you have that?
I get it sometimes, but all too infrequently. every once in a while, I'm so living the story that the room around me, the calendar on the wall, the deer eating the zinnias outside, it all blurs away. And it's the story that is where I'm living. It doesn't happen that often. I don't know whether it's a matter of brain chemistry or what it is, the muse, if you will. But I love when it happens because usually that's when the surprises come, things I hadn't expected.
But as you also point out, there's a thin membrane between the voice in her head that's her abuser, that's constantly, you know, telling her you're never going to get rid of me, and the artistic cyclone.
Yes, yeah. She's goaded into making this angry art of hers by the voice in her head that haunts her.
Yeah. USA Today wrote, it's the kind of book where you get to the last two chapters and you really want to find out how those loose ends tie up, but you don't want to go too fast because then it'll be over. When it was over for you, Wally Lamb, do you feel in a way that you did justice to that mother that you remember as a child? What a story.
Well, what happened while I was writing this book is that a cousin of those three little boys who were rescued from the tree called me up. Out of the blue, I didn't know her, and she said, would you like to be connected to Tom and Jim and Sean Moody?
Wait, did she know you were writing the book?
And yes, she had heard that on a radio station interview.
Yeah.
So through her, I met Tom Moody, who as a four-year-old was the only one who remembered his mother and also the only one who remembered the night of the flood and going underwater in their car. Mm. So he and I and his two brothers met at the dam site. You know, the flood had happened because a dam collapsed. And we walked the flood path and we found the tree. It was one of the most moving things that ever happened in my life. We found that, you know, the Moody brothers called it the Tree of Life, and indeed it was for them because that was where they were rescued from. But unfortunately, it's a sad place too because it's the place where their mother's body was found.
But how did they feel about in a way, her story finally being told through your novel?
Well, they're very happy with it, but also it's not the only avenue of storytelling. Tom Moody, that older brother, he wrote the nonfiction version of The Flood. And so while I was writing my novel and he was writing his nonfiction, we would swap back and forth and give each other feedback. And his book is called A Strange and Deadly Maelstrom.
Well, a twofer, Wally Lamb.
Yeah.
And again, the other story that you make people aware of, say again the name of the real-life African-American artist from Connecticut.
His name is Ellis Ruley. He did die under mysterious circumstances. He was somewhat controversial in town because he was an African-American with a white wife in 1950s America. Mm-hmm. He received money from an insurance settlement, and so he had a big, nice car, and he bought property. And the black community feels that his death was not accidental, as the coroner ruled it, and that he was a target of a racial killing.
Well, and in your novel, you give them a far more satisfying answer to his death than they may be getting in real life. Always a pleasure, Wally. Thanks so much.
And for me, too. Coming here to your studio here in Boston is like coming home for me.
Oh, thanks, and it's great to have you here.
Thanks.
And Wally Lamb's We Are Water is now out in paperback. We spoke last October. You're listening to Here and Now. It's estimated that 80% of the cocaine sold in the U.S. comes from Guatemala. So it's not surprising that there's a growing addiction problem in that Central American country. But there are no government treatment centers for the growing number of addicts there. So churches have filled the vacuum, opening their own centers. The BBC's Linda Presley visited one.
The doors are locked behind us at Rescatados del Abismo, rescued from the abyss. This is a rehabilitation centre run by a Christian former addict on an ordinary street in the capital. When I visit, there are 54 internees milling around in a space the size of a large three-bedroom flat. I don't meet anyone who has chosen to be here. Carlos is an internee too, with a history of addiction to crack cocaine and alcohol. But he's also in charge of maintaining discipline here, and a trusted lieutenant who goes to collect addicts when the centre gets a call from a family distressed and worried about a loved one.
El paciente cuando está drogado responde violentamente.
They're oftentimes very violent, so it's our role to bring them here. And that can mean using handcuffs, just like the police. So when the family calls, they'll say our son is very violent and has a machete or a knife or is armed. And so we go and we tie him up and bring him here.
And is that legal?
Sí, sí.
In this society here in Guatemala, when someone is using drugs, they give up their autonomy and the decision falls on the family.
And all of the people who we've here, have most of them been brought to the centre in that way?
The vast majority, 95%, are here against their will.
Jessica is one of them. You've got Timoy.
Yes, I've been here for 3 months already.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe the power of the Holy Spirit. And if you really believe in this power, you can change anything in your life.
Are there a lot of fights and things here?
Yes, a lot.
And so what do you do all day then?
Just meetings, 3 meetings a day, and that's it.
Attendance at the meetings for 7 hours a day is compulsory. Internees take it in turns to talk to the group, stories about their descent into addiction, and the hope that Jesus Christ will come to their aid.
Here in Guatemala, the real language of change is by way of the church.
Professor Kevin O'Neill is an anthropologist at Toronto University who's been researching centres like this one. He estimates there are perhaps 200 of them run by Protestant churches in Guatemala and that they hold maybe 6,000 people.
Cocaine, and especially crack cocaine, has increased the number of centres dramatically in the capital city. But it's also changed the culture inside the centers. The internal dynamics have become much more aggressive and discipline-driven because of the rise of crack cocaine.
There's no data on how successful the rehabilitation of addicts in Guatemala is. Most experts in the West will tell you compulsory rehabilitation is doomed to fail. People have to want to stop. But Pablo Marroquin, the director and founder of Rescatados del Abismo, is a testament to his own Christian approach.
I experienced God's mercy. He rescued me.
People always talk about the violation of human rights of the addict. What about families? What we do is give families peace so that their loved one doesn't get himself into trouble.
In Guatemala, the family and the Protestant church are perhaps the most important institutions. And often, they're the only safety net for those caught in a spiral of addiction.
The BBC's Linda Presley in Guatemala. You're listening to Here and Now.
The World Health Organization warned today that the Ebola virus in West Africa could ultimately infect more than 20,000 people. Since the outbreak began in March, 1,300 people have died from it, and the WHO fears the death toll could reach 10,000. As a precaution, many universities around the world have suspended fall semester abroad programs in the affected areas. Other schools are taking steps to prevent the disease from spreading on their campuses, either through students who come from West Africa or who have visited the region. Joining us to talk about what's happening on that front at Liberty University, a private Christian college in Lynchburg, Virginia, is Dr. Richard Lane. He's director of Liberty's Master of Public Health program. Dr. Lane, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
And what kind of Ebola precautions is Liberty taking?
Yeah, well, we knew we had some international students. Like many large universities, we recruit students from abroad, and we wanted to look and see how many we had coming, see how soon before classes they were arriving, and determine whether there was actually any risk. Turns out I have about 17 from Nigeria, and we're looking at some of the other countries as we hear of new strains of Ebola that are breaking out in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There was a report actually in Ghana of suspected cases, which I think have been ruled out at this point. And then we have also students that would travel independently over the summer on missions trips or maybe on business or to see relatives abroad. And we needed to find out if any of them had indeed gone to an Ebola-infected area.
And if they had, what approach are you taking?
Well, obviously, if they didn't travel to those portions of Africa, there's no risk. If they travel to those particular countries, there's not necessarily a risk. And people need to understand that. I kind of compare it to, you heard of a case of some outbreak of disease, say, in Montana, and you're worried that you might pick it up in Virginia. Well, obviously, that's a long ways away. The chance of picking that disease up is essentially zero. And the same is true when you're in an African nation. You've got a big country, and just because there's a disease in some area of that country, even if it's across town, doesn't mean you're at risk of being exposed to that disease. And so our next layer was to say, hey, are you from any of the villages or neighborhoods or the regions of the country where Ebola has been spotted? If not, you've really got a fairly low risk. And if anybody identified themselves as, yes, I know somebody, then they're a high risk and we'd want to monitor them.
And how are you doing that monitoring?
Yeah, basically, I have one of my grad students go down and interview them, determine whether or not they've had direct contact. And the good news is none of them have had direct contact. But just to be on the extra safe side, because it makes our community feel better, we've asked those students to just take their temperature twice a day. One of the very first signs of Ebola is fever. And there are criteria that have been established by CDC to look for the symptoms, and fever is the thing. In fact, many airports now are actually using thermoscans on people coming through those areas.
Right.
And pulling them aside if they've had a temperature as a walk through. So easy step to do, and I'm happy to report no students have had fever at this point.
So if you did have a student who had been to one of the affected parts of Africa and did report an elevated temperature, what steps would Liberty be taking?
Then what we would do is we actually have a number of protocols set up with the hospitals here in town, emergency response teams here in town, and with our health department here in town to coordinate the care and transfer of that person so that no one be put at risk.
Ebola has a 3-week incubation period. So are you allowing the students who you are monitoring to travel freely around the campus during
that
3 weeks?
They are attending class, yes, ma'am, because they are not infectious as long as there's no fever. So they check it in the morning, and if they feel good through the day, they should not be a risk to anybody. I actually have a number of them in my classes personally, and it's been kind of fun interacting with them. The good news is, like I say, none of them have been knowingly exposed to Ebola, so the risk should be essentially zero.
And why do you say it's been fun to interact with them?
Because they can tell you how their country's responding and the fear that some of these people experience in their countries. And they bring a real understanding of how the culture works and how the lack of infrastructure in these African nations contributes to the occurrence of Ebola.
So you're getting an interesting point of view from students from other countries.
Very unique point of view of these students. My specialty happens to be public health and tropical medicine. I've actually traveled through these areas many times myself. So I know the region, but their particular perspective as someone who's lived there, someone who's born there and raised there, gives just a different flavor for understanding the culture.
You mentioned that no student has reported an elevated temperature, no fever, and that while you're monitoring them, they can travel freely around campus. If someone did report an elevated temperature, would they immediately be removed from the general student population?
We'd immediately remove them from the campus and put them in an isolated room until transport could come, get them to a place where they could be isolated again, and then have blood testing done to look for Ebola.
Dr. Lane, some schools in the U.S. and Europe have international study programs in parts of Africa, like Sierra Leone and Nigeria, and they have canceled them to reduce the risk of students becoming infected. Does Liberty have any travel programs that you have made changes to because of Ebola?
Well, we have a lot of international travel going on, both officially as part of the university and also as independent trips from some of our students. We looked at all of those, and we were very happy that we did not schedule any to those particular countries that we needed to cancel this year. Though I will say we have been there before, and once this is blown over, we will go there again. I also have a faculty member that was nearby in Cameroon, an adjacent country. She was over and came back, so not affected. I also have a team of students and one of my faculty members going to Benin in December. Of course, that is very close to these countries, and we're watching that situation very closely. We'll go on the trip as long as it doesn't strike in Benin. Hopefully it'll be over by December, though.
Dr. Richard Lane is director of the Masters of Public Health Program at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. Dr. Lane, thank you.
Pleasure being with you.
Meanwhile, some potential good news in the fight against Ebola. Starting next week, federal researchers will begin testing humans with an experimental vaccine to prevent the disease. The National Institutes of Health said today that it is launching the safety trial on the vaccine. And on Tuesday, researchers will test 20 healthy adult volunteers to see if it triggers an adequate response in their immune systems. Even though NIH has been testing other Ebola vaccines in people since 2003, this is a first for this vaccine. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now. Business Week is calling her Silicon Valley's tennis startup. California's 15-year-old Cece Bellis of Atherton plays again at the U.S. Open today, taking on Kazakhstan's Zarina Dias. Earlier in the week, Cece became the youngest player since Anna Kournikova in 1996 to win a match at the Open, beating a 12th-ranked player. Even the cameras seemed shocked because Cece is ranked 1,208th. John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated is at the Open in Flushing Meadows, New York. John, how big is this?
Through 4 days, this has been the story of the tournament. And it's funny, nobody really saw this coming. There usually is a sort of a first-week darling, but nobody expected it to be a 15-year-old. And again, we talked the other day how tennis has really gotten to be such an older sport. Serena Williams, you know, 33 years old, Roger Federer, 33 years old. So for a 15-year-old to make a splash like this is really not just a fun story, but really sort of runs counter to the trends in tennis right now.
We're hearing, though, from people now talking about her game that there is something very centered about her. She comes from a family in Silicon Valley that, you know, like others in the neighborhood, they have a tennis court and a pool in the backyard. So obviously she's homeschooled. So there's been a lot of concentration on her, but her coaches are talking about how she just has a very nice posture, is how it's put.
Yeah, you know, and everybody's sort of dancing around the socioeconomics. Her, her father is in private equity in the Silicon Valley. You get the feeling that the prize money here is not going to make or break the family finances. And I wonder if that isn't a source of some comfort. I mean, there are players here, particularly non-American, that have immense pressure. Petra Kvitova, who won the Wimbledon singles title, was talking about how she knew at an early age she was playing, you know, so her parents could have a better life. That doesn't seem to be the case here, and I wonder if that, in the long run, isn't an advantage, that, you know, she doesn't have the financial pressures that other players here do.
Well, in fact, she got into the U.S. Open on a wild card. She wondered if she even deserved to be there. Her coach had said she did, and hasn't got a lot of earnings.
No. I mean, her ranking is outside the top 1,000, and, you know, she hasn't kept any of the prize money because that would, you know, make her a professional and would that would sort of obviate her getting a college scholarship. So regardless of how she does here, she will not be keeping any of the prize money.
Although her, I think her father did say if she won the whole thing.
$3 million, yeah. you can make different decisions. But no, I mean, the family's been very clear, and they sort of know the reality, which is there have been a lot of players who have had early hype and then haven't lived up to it. And, you know, Melanie Udan was the darling here 5 years ago and was on all the morning shows, and it was a similar sort of first-week story. And yet, Melanie Udan did not even qualify for the main draw this year. So I think there are enough of these cautionary tales sort of littering the landscape that the family might be careful here.
But there are also a lot of young American women catching our attention. There was 18-year-old Taylor Townsend. Of course, she had the bad luck this time of having to play Serena Williams and didn't advance. But then there's Madison Keys, a 19-year-old American. Is there something going on with young female American players?
I think you're right to add female because there are only 3 American men left. This is the most dismal showing ever for the American men, and yet the women's side is really flourishing. And I think some of this is the effect of Serena Williams, I think. I think some of this is the fact that tennis sort of economically makes more sense for women. There's no NFL and none of the sort of the team sports that can attract athletes at an earlier age. But, yeah, for as poorly as the American men's scene looks right now, the women, there are a lot of signs for encouragement. And also there's a real diversity in every sense. I mean, ethnic diversity, economic diversity, diversity of bodies. So it's really nice to see.
Well, and we'll be watching specifically today 15-year-old Cece Bellis. John Wertheim of Sports Illustrated at the U.S. Open, thank you.
My pleasure, anytime.
The college football season is kicking off this season with some off-the-field news. The University of Southern California has suspended starting cornerback Josh Shaw. That's after he told school officials that he had made up a story about rescuing a nephew from a pool and lied about how he suffered ankle injuries. Shaw's indefinite suspension is a blow for what the Trojans can do on the field this year. They're projected to be a top 20 team, and they're a good bet to earn a bowl berth. But big-time college football teams will be looking for more than just bowl games this year. They want to be among the top 4 teams in the nation because this season, for the first time, there will be a real playoff for the championship. John Bacon is the author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. He joins us from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Sasha.
And John, first of all, would you explain the new playoff system to us for those who don't know the details?
Sasha, we don't have that much time, but in a nutshell, only college football can make it that complicated, and they have done that. In a nutshell, you've got a committee of 13 people who are going to decide pick 4 teams to play in a 4-team playoff, and that's it. So the first round is on New Year's Day. You got the 4 teams playing on that day. Then within 6 days or 7 days, you're going to have the next Monday is going to be the final game. So 4 teams playing 2 games, and that's it.
You said a committee. Who is on that committee?
Almost everyone you can think of, amazingly. 13 people, 5 athletic directors from the 5 power conferences. That makes sense. You've also got some legends like Tom Osborne, Archie Manning, the old quarterback, of course, whose sons play in the NFL, Eli and Peyton. And perhaps a bit surprising, Condoleezza Rice. You would know her, of course, from her time in the Bush administration.
So is the view out there, and I'm sure it's a mixed view, that the new playoff system will really be better than the old system?
That better be the hope, obviously, after all these struggles to make all this happen. The fans largely want it. The press seems to really want it. I'm one of these dinosaurs who likes the old way. The downside is going to be that it diminishes not just the regular season now, which is the only regular season where every game actually matters, but also the bowl system itself. So when you win on New Year's Day, you're not done. And that, I think, might have a corrosive effect. That said, TV does not agree with me. They're going to pay $470 million for that tournament every year from ESPN.
Big money, major money, and it sounds like clearly that's the motivation for the change.
What do you think, Sasha?
I'd say the answer to that question is yes.
I think you're dead right, Sasha.
You know, John, we should explain the old bowl championship series was basically based on computers. Tell us a little bit about the old way.
Yeah, well, the really old way, of course, is all the bowls just picked their teams based on conference affiliations, and so the top 2 teams very rarely met in the bowl games. You might have one at the Rose Bowl, one at the Orange Bowl playing somebody else. Then the new system, the BCS system, starting in 98, picked the top 2 teams to play a national title game, but then people complain about that because it's all based about computers and polls. Now you've got 13 people who are going to decide that themselves based on what, Sasha? You guessed it, computers and polls. So the improvement there, I'm not quite getting.
John, earlier this week, we had on the show author Steve Almond. He has a new book out called Against Football, A Reluctant Fan's Manifesto. And Robin had talked to him. You know, he's a fan, but he has, for a number of reasons, you know, including that schools and teams rake in money while players often get brain injuries. He says he is not going to watch anymore. And as Robin knows, we got huge listener reaction
John,
to that.
John, it was unbelievable. It blew up social media. You know, he talks not only about the pros in college, but a study of high school kids that was trying to determine whether or not they had brain damage, and they couldn't find a control group because they couldn't find kids that didn't have some sort of concussion who had been playing football. So just what your thoughts, though, about somebody saying, I'm not going to watch?
I heard the interview was very good, very smart guy, obviously. He made a lot of very good points. I think the low-lying fruit is NFL not being a nonprofit. People can't believe this when I tell them this. It is a nonprofit, thanks to all those glorious volunteers, of course, for that noble cause of NFL. And, of course, the stadium subsidies. In the U.S. alone, by the way, we've spent over $21 billion on stadium subsidies in the last 30 years. That's insane. The hard part, I think the hardest thing to solve is the concussion issue, because that will not be solved without changing the game dramatically. I played high school hockey, went through a few helmets the hard way myself, and you can judge for yourself the damage done. But that is very difficult to take out of the game entirely. Yeah. It is almost an assumed risk, like driving a car.
Yeah, I mean, Steve's book and his appearance on the show has just burned up our Facebook page.
Go to hearandnow.org.
A lot of comments. We were interested in everyone else's comments.
Oh, I have.
Yeah. So for listeners who haven't heard it, you can find it on our website. We want to know what you think. Even if you're a football lover, do you agree with Steve Almond that we have to stop watching because of the way the sport is run?
But John Bacon has a book, too.
He does. John Bacon's latest book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. John, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Sasha.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.